From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, a review of new bills introduced this month in Lansing.
And, you know, I've gotten some pretty good response of this from people who want to see what's being proposed in Lansing before all of a sudden there's the final vote for it.
Should we spend big money to upgrade our transportation infrastructure? One innovator thinks there's a better way.
I think there's a lot of danger in these huge public work projects. I'm a much bigger believer in fixing what we have now and synchronizing it.
A Corktown business owner on recent car thefts and what he does for security.
I spend about $30,000 a year. It's the difference between making money and losing money last year. The accountant says we lost $10,000, and we spent $30,000 on security.
Those stories and much more today on Stateside. A rash of car thefts from popular Corktown bars and restaurants is posing constant challenges to the community of Detroit business owners.
I spend about $30,000 a year. It's the difference between making money and losing money last year. The accountant says we lost $10,000, and we spent $30,000 on security.
I'm Cynthia Canty. Today on Stateside, the realities of building a business in Detroit. But first,
vision.
Part of the community. It's the next idea.
Our infrastructure is our collective ability to say what we care about.
The story of James Robertson, the Detroit man who walked 21 miles every day to get from his Detroit home to his job in Rochester Hills, certainly drew worldwide attention. And it got a lot of people in Southeast Michigan talking about the woeful state of Michigan's existing transit infrastructure. But our partner in The Next Idea questions whether pouring big money into new public transit is really the answer. Jeff DeGraff is with the Ross School of Business at the University of Michigan. And Jeff, there are some very convincing arguments for, you know, big new public transportation that you go through a lot of those in your essay, such as?
Well, one of the big things is, of course, there's a social justice issue here. You know, is transportation available to people who need it to get back and forth to work, to get good food, to get health care? And that's a real concern. And I think in a civil society, you have to take those things very seriously. I think on the other side of it, there's an issue of does this make economic sense? And in the essay, I look at some of these areas where we do have light rail and we do have some new novel ideas in how to increase ridership. And in most of those cases, they're not very successful, at least economically. Now, there are cases where they are, where there's a lot of density, like in the urban corridor in the East Coast, but that's mostly city-to-city rail, and it connects to the light rail within the cities. But where places are more separated and places are less densely populated, like some of the urban core up here in the northern Midwest, I'm not sure that makes sense economically.
So you point out in your essay for The Next Idea that major public transit infrastructure projects, they did actually help rejuvenate Oakland and Brooklyn, but you don't think that could be Detroit?
Well, I think there was a core of urban density in both of these particular areas. And both of them are adjacent to a high job growth area. So that's where part of the spillover came. So these areas were blighted at one time. They became gentrified simply because of the price of housing. But there are very few other examples of that.
So what's the answer for places like the Detroit area that don't have a lot to work with to start out with?
Well, I think there's kind of three big issues here that you have to deal with. The first one is simply the infrastructure that we have. What are we doing with it? And I think I'd start with a very basic issue of the roads. As you well know, this has become a political hot potato. Mm-hmm. Now, two of the three issues around roads are things that we can't control. We live in a very extreme environment, Michigan. Things get very hot and very cold. When water seeps into the asphalt and it expands into ice, we all know it cracks the roads. Same is true with concrete. So there's very little you can do around that. You have to maintain those roads probably a lot more than you do in other climates. Two, there's the second question, of course, of the state itself sits on 95% of all the surface freshwater in the United States. And if you've ever dug any deep hole in the state of Michigan, we're all living on this gray toothpaste, basically. And it's really not, great bedrock to build a road on. But the third one is a very interesting one, which is the state of Michigan load limit for over-the-road carriers is 164,000 pounds. Now, the national average is 80. So what you realize is we're over twice what the national average is. The next closest states, I think, are Wisconsin and Louisiana, which are around 100. So there's this big issue of, because of our history in the automobile industry and because of those special interests, you know, what we're putting on these roads is very, very detrimental to the surface street. So no matter what any scenario you come up with, the first thing you have to do, whether you're driving a bus or driving a car or whatever kind of service you have to fix the roads. So we have this first issue about we have to maintain the very basic infrastructure that we have. It's like clean water. Roads are one of the things that you have to have in order to have a productive society. Mm-hmm. But having said that, one of the interesting challenges is we actually have a lot of the pieces to make this work. We have bus systems. We have rail systems. We have train systems. But there's a couple of problems.
Such as?
One, we haven't reinvested in them very much. A lot of those are antiquated and have been neglected for years. I know in Detroit recently they just bought 50 new buses, and that's quite a nice step in the right direction,
right?
Yes, but we all know that there's quite a number of new buses that need to be added to that. And of course, the second piece that kind of goes with that is, are these systems synchronized?
And that's what we saw with, for example, Mr. Robertson having to get from Detroit to Rochester Hills, which has opted out. So it's not synchronized very much at all, is it?
It's an amazing thing. If you travel as much as I do, you go to Europe or I just came back from Beijing. Mm-hmm. You know, you get off the plane, you get on the train. The train takes you to the city center where the bus station is. The bus station has buses that run on a regular basis. You can buy tickets to the next leg of your journey at any given place. They're cost effective. And these are considered just sort of part of the ebb and flow of how people move around. They're highly synchronized.
And you can tweak them as needed.
You can tweak them as needed. Yeah. And there are adjustments that are made, more so like in Western Europe if you land in Amsterdam, et cetera, less so when you're in East Asia. But the notion is they are sensitive to the other upstream and downstream legs of transportation. This seems to me like an obvious thing that's relatively easy to do with low-level software and simply some mobile communication that you can connect these transportation systems. But of course, that would take a sort of a different view about how these things operate and a different view about what the role of the municipality is in managing this.
Well, you point out in your essay with the rise of ride-sharing services like Uber and Lyft, you kind of see a future where public transit could really be replaced altogether?
I think one of the wonderful things about technology is that when people in government don't make decisions, technology will make the decisions for them from the outside in. And one of the things that I see happening, and I think it's happening all over the place in Ann Arbor, is that places like Lyft and Uber are creating quite a large presence in this economy because they're younger people, they're more fluent in technology, peer-to-peer technology, and they're more cost sensitive. Mm-hmm. And the notion is they want things on demand. So one of the things that I think right off the bat is a real possibility, and you're seeing this in places like Los Angeles already happen, is that these cars are creating sort of a self-organized ride-sharing community, and they're bypassing the municipalities altogether.
Well, but, look at people like James Robertson and people. He at least had a job. But what about people who don't have a job, who are stuck in, let's say, in those urban areas in Detroit with no options and hopping on an expensive smartphone to check on an Uber or Lyft ride isn't an option for them?
I think there's a lot of in-between things you can do. So, for example, one of the things that schools and churches are very good at is organizing communities and organizing ride sharing. Why couldn't we involve them in this? Why couldn't we support some of those options? They seem to be much more cost effective than a lot of infrastructure spend, right? So one of the things is you make it available in those intermediate places so that Mr. Robertson can actually get a ride. And the second thing is more and more the issue is going to be who has access to these digital webs. Who has the technology to do this? And how do we make that cost effective for people? So maybe the issue about roads is moving from physical roads to these digital roads. And the digital roads, the good news, cost a lot less to build and require a lot less investment in the infrastructure.
So that leads to my next question. We have so many organizations and government officials and residents who are focusing on trying to find new public transit solutions for Southeast Michigan. So in your view, where's the best place for long-term investment?
I think I'd do three things right off the bat. Obviously, the roads have to be fixed under any scenario. This is the automobile state. For the car state, we got to be able to drive our cars. Two, I think the bus system has got to be reinvested in a lot of these areas. And I think we may need to support some of these interconnected routes between Rochester and Detroit and all of the adjacent areas. And three, scheduling technology needs to be updated, I think, in this state so that it can be a low-level app that basically synchronizes these systems like we see in Europe and like we see in East Asia. So I think there are three kind of very simple steps. I think they're a lot more cost-effective than building sort of large intercity rail systems. I don't know if you've been reading about the runaway train in California that they had an initiative for $9 billion to build a fast train between San Francisco and Los Angeles, and now it's well over $70 billion, and the return on investment is generational, and that's even the best case scenario. So I think there's a lot of danger in these huge public work projects. I'm a much bigger believer in fixing what we have now and synchronizing it and maybe allowing this new world of technology, the Ubers, the Lyfts, the handheld technologies, the scheduling rides in a peer-to-peer way, allowing them to also enter into the picture. Because quite frankly, I don't think the government is going to be able to regulate them one way or the other. I think it's inevitable that it's going to happen.
Jeff DeGraff is a professor at the Ross School of Business at the University of Michigan and, of course, is our partner in The Next Idea. You can find Jeff's essay at the Next Idea page at michiganradio.org and share your thoughts on whether or not Michigan ought to be investing in big new public transit. You can share them in the comments section underneath Jeff's essay or at Michigan Radio's Facebook page or, as always, on Twitter at Next Idea MI. As always, thank you so much, Jeff.
Thank you, Cynthia.
Support for The Next Idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.
Coming up next, March Madness Brackets. Yep, it's that time again. Why flipping a coin may be your best bet. And then a salute to companies who've been with us for at least a century and who have made our lives better.
Every time you take a drink of delicious Detroit water or flush your toilet, you can thank Clarence Hubbell.
That's in 10 minutes. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Well, March Madness brackets are out and it has begun. The national obsession with your bracket. A lot of time, a lot of money will go into those basketball pools. Well, now a University of Michigan professor steps forward to tell us you could have better odds of having a successful March Madness bracket if you just flip a coin. Dae-Hee Kwok is an assistant professor of sports management at the School of Kinesiology at U of M. Your newly published study is in the Journal of Gambling Studies. What were you trying to figure out?
We were interested in the idea of winning confidence that participants, that they build into filling out their brackets. So we kind of felt it was interesting to see, compared to filling out a number on a lottery, filling out a bracket, they seem to overrate their confidence in winning. And we wanted to see that in the March Madness context. So we did a couple of studies on it.
Okay, how'd you construct them?
So first study, we examined the idea of filling out the selection process itself, whether it increases winning confidence. We divided participants into one of two groups. One group with empty bracket, and then they were told to actually fill out the brackets, make their own 63 predictions.
Just the way that people are doing
exactly.
In offices today all over the country.
Exactly. And the other group, they were given the same bracket, but they were told not to fill out their brackets. And we wanted to see how their winning estimation changes after controlling for their past bracket behaviors, their perceived basketball knowledge, age and gender, etc. We saw a significant difference on estimating their perceived winning confidence on winning their bracket.
Now, when you say perceived winning confidence, mm-hmm. What does that mean?
We asked participants from 0 to 100%, what is the likelihood that you'll win your pool?
All right.
So some people would say 80% chance that I'm going to win, and some might feel less confident. So we just want to see the mean difference on the perceived winning confidence.
Okay, so now that we know that, what'd you find?
So as expected, people in the selection process, they overestimated their winning procedure, but it wasn't sure whether their confidence actually translates to performance. So that's why we did the second study. So we did see the winning confidence. The perceived winning confidence is different based on the selection process. So my mom would fill out her bracket, and she would feel confident as well as I am. So we wanted to make sure that the confident people actually perform better on their bracket. So we did a second study. We invited 200 Michigan alumni and students to fill out their brackets in a mock March Madness challenge. We tracked all their scores after 3 weeks of the tournament to make sure whether their winning confidence predicts better performance. We also measured maximum willingness to wager on their bracket if they had a chance. How much would you wager? And we compared the high-confident group versus low-confident group on their financial risk-taking, and we found that high-confident group reported that they would bet on their predictions 2.6 times higher than the less confident group.
They're feeling sassy.
So it does relate to higher financial risk-taking, which is in line with gambling literature. But more interestingly, we wanted to know whether their confidence actually performed better. So we compared the high-confident, less-confident, low-confident group, and then compared the actual performance scores. But we did not see a statistical significant differences based on their confidence level.
And then where does the part about the coin flipping come in?
So after seeing this, their knowledge builds into the confidence, and confidence leads to actual financial risk-taking. But at the end, it doesn't really relate to actual performance. So we wanted to see if random picks by coin flipping can outperform these participants. As a side of an informal study, that's why we decided, let's flip a coin and see how we can do compared to these hard-thought-out brackets. And then we did three sets of coin flipping, and it was on 2011 where we conducted a study, and that was a season that happened to be the none of the top seeded teams went into Final Four.
Everybody's brackets got blown and smashed, didn't it?
Exactly. And then our scores got slightly better than the average of the entire participants. There were so many upsets in the game. I think it was the second time after 2006 that none of the top seeded team advanced to Final Four. But who would have expected that?
Yeah. So let me see if I get this right. We have better odds of having a successful bracket by flipping a coin than by using any of that expert knowledge or confidence of basketball, which means anyone from your six-year-old cousin to your 80-year-old grandma has a decent shot at winning the bracket.
I think it depends on how many upsets we have, but that's something that we can't really predict in advance. In the same year that we conducted this study, three basketball analysts from ESPN.com, Sports Illustrated, and CBS Sports, they got their own predictions on the Final Four, and only one analyst out of three got one team out of four correct. So 11 out of 12 teams was incorrect, but we would not argue that those analysts are less knowledgeable or than the basketball average fans.
What does this mean for all the fans who spend all these hours planning out their brackets and reviewing and hashing out team statistics? Like, why do it?
Exactly. Their time consuming those statistics and going through this team's information, it all increases winning confidence, which is a strongest predictor of enjoyment.
Okay, so you have a good time doing it.
Exactly. So you're going to indulge yourself with all this basketball insider picks and the blogs and analysts from those so-called experts out there. You're going to have a good time feeling that you have a good feeling that you're going to make some correct predictions on the upsets.
Even if you aren't really statistically going to.
Well, yeah, based on our data, that there are some times that maybe your upset picks, you might make the correct picks, which will reinforce the idea of illusion of control. You're going to attribute your correct pick based on your skill, not on the luck, but you're going to attribute your losses on bad luck.
All right. So, yeah, you don't look at the mirror and go, I didn't get it right.
Exactly.
It was just my bad luck. So it's a happy distraction at the workplace for so many Americans, but
you have to be reminded that there are a certain level of luck that comes into play, so don't spend too much time.
Have you filled out your bracket yet?
No.
Are you going to use a coin flipping method?
Maybe some of the uncertain matchups.
Do you have a lucky coin?
No, I don't.
Not at all. Dehi Kuok is an assistant professor of sports management at the School of Kinesiology at the University of Michigan. His study on March Madness brackets and luck versus skill, you can find it in the Journal of Gambling Studies. So good to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
There is a lot of attention and a lot of talk in this state directed at startups about attracting new business. And all that's well and good. But writer Eileen Wolf wants to pay tribute to some venerable longtime Michigan businesses and her story for the latest edition of D Business. It's the Century Club, Michigan firms and businesses that really have withstood this test of time. Eileen Wolf, it's good to have you back here on Stateside.
Good afternoon, Cindy. Thanks for having me.
What did it take for a firm or an institution to make the cut and be included in your story?
Well, 100 years old or older, and with a real strong tie or a location in Detroit.
We'll start then with Armelie Brands, founded in the Bahamas in 1908. Mm-hmm. Tell us about them.
Well, 1908 in the Bahamas, harvesting sea sponges. And eventually the son of the founder moved to Detroit, set up business on Iron Street right by the riverfront, processed sponges, natural sponges for a long time. Eventually natural sponges died out, and the company was savvy enough to buy from Simonize a sponge technology called Estracell. And for you germaphobes out there, this is especially nice because they're supposed to be more sanitary than natural or other man-made sponges.
And they're still doing it. And they actually got the rights to the Brillo pad.
They did. They bought Brillo several years ago. And I think they just saw a good thing and decided it fits right in with their book of business. And they went for it.
And the family name on the building is very, very important to them.
Well, it is. And actually, the president told me kind of a nice story. When Ford Motor Company stock unfortunately dropped below $2 a share during our last recession, he told his broker to go ahead and buy. And the broker said, well, are you sure you want to do this? And he said, yes, as long as the Ford name is on their building, they are not going to let that company go out of business. And
they didn't.
Of course, they've turned around.
And here in our Armelie, with the family still at the helm, is going strong.
Exactly.
Next, we have Hubbell, Roth, and Clark. And we know that water from Detroit's system is always praised for its very, very good taste. And it turns out we have Clarence Hubbell to thank for that.
Well, thanks to current President Jed Hubbell's great-grandfather, Clarence. Yes, he was an engineer in Detroit who designed the Detroit Wastewater Treatment Plant, which is an award-winning treatment plant. And yes, every time you take a drink of delicious Detroit water or flush your toilet, you can thank Clarence Hubbell.
And Hubbell, as you say, Jed is still at the helm of the company.
Yes, he is. Great guy, extremely gregarious. When I sat down to talk with him, it was like talking to one of my brothers.
Hmm. We have the Grosse Pointe Yacht Club, and it's been interesting to think that they opened that famous clubhouse near Lakeshore just as the Great Depression hit. So how did this yacht club survive the Great Depression and all the economic ups and downs since?
I know. It's so ironic. Shortly after they opened that brand new beautiful clubhouse that kind of looks like a church, they had to close their doors during the Great Depression. And it was only through the mechanics of some former members who re-upped that they were able to buy back the property from the bank for pennies on the dollar.
And stay alive.
And stay alive. And they're going great guns today, and I'm sure that they're extremely relevant to their members.
Yeah, the Engineering Society of Detroit, I love the way you put in your story for D Business. Before there was LinkedIn, there was the ESD.
Well, of course. I mean, anyone who's in any profession, the very first thing you should do is join your professional society and become involved in it. And they're a great example. Roy Link, who is one of the former presidents of the Engineering Society, told me that he actually walked in the doors when he was 16 years old. He didn't join then, but he now is president of his own company, and he's always had someone to go to if he had any kind of an engineering issue or needed someone in a different trade to bring into a project. The Engineering Society of Detroit was his sort of hub.
And even 100 years some later, they've moved to Southfield from where they used to be. They used to be right across from the DIA. I remember that Rackham building. But how much of a role are they playing to work to attract young people to engineering and STEM careers or get STEM jobs to Michigan?
Mm-hmm. Well, actually, they are active in a program for upper elementary students to become involved in those kinds of fields. And they're also trying to establish student chapters at local universities like Lawrence Tech.
So they're still working it. And then you give everybody's sweet tooth a treat. You salute Murdoch's Fudge, still going after 128 years. What has been the key to that company's longevity, do you think?
Can you honestly believe that? Mm-hmm. You know, I think it's the quality ingredients and paying attention to keeping the old recipes from the original Sarah Murdoch, and staying true to their main business.
And the Murdochs did sell to the current owners, the Benser family, but that family clearly had that vision that they kind of carried through intact.
The Benser, who bought the business from the Murdoch family, was actually like a son to the to them at the time, and that's why he got the opportunity to buy the business.
So what big lessons do you think these companies can teach us from their long histories?
Mm-hmm. I think there are several lessons. And, you know, this is the fifth time that I've written Century Club for D Business. And what I've noticed in businesses is that you have to be ready to change. For instance, Armelie Brands, sea sponges were dying off, so they bought a synthetic sponge. You have to be willing to invest in intangibles like supporting your employees' growth and development. And you also have to take pride in your work. And this is one thing that Jed Hubbell said to me, that it was always drummed into them that they had to do their absolute best for their clients. Many of the businesses are family-owned businesses, and what I've really noticed a common thread there is that they get the kids involved early. A year or two ago, I wrote about Bacharis Brothers Coffee in Detroit, delicious coffee, by the way, and we ran a photo of Nick Bacharis, who's current company president, when he was 4 years old, at the business. Mm-hmm. So get them involved early seems to be the key to keeping the family going business after the first and second generations.
Eileen Wolf paying tribute to some venerable, longtime Michigan businesses in her story. You can find it in the latest edition of D Business at dbusiness.com. And the piece is called The Century Club. Eileen, always good to talk with you.
Thank you very much for having me.
You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio.
State of Michigan.
Ensuring quality products today.
Just about anywhere you see young parents, there's a pretty good chance you'll see Action Baby Carriers. They allow you to wear your baby or toddler and wear them nice and close to you, an alternate to pushing baby in a stroller. And the Action Baby Carrier is made in Michigan. Andrea Govender is here. She and her husband own Action Baby Carriers. What does it mean, Andrea, to wear your baby?
Well, we make a carrier that you buckled to your body so that you can be hands-free and still have your baby nice and close to you.
And the baby is facing out or facing in?
Our carrier's baby faces in. The reason why is because it's easier to get baby in a more ergonomic position when they're facing in towards your body. It's also a lot more comfortable for both the baby and the wearer because when they're facing you, their weight is more in line with your body, so it's easier to carry them for longer periods of time.
Now, you and your husband bought the company in 2013, but the company actually started in Michigan, didn't it?
It did, yeah. We bought it from a couple who was running it up north near Alpena.
Well, there's nothing like a parent of two little ones with one on the way to be a great advertisement for your own product. Where do you produce the carriers?
We make them in Detroit.
And how big do you hope Action Carriers will get?
You know, we'd like to grow, but we also want to make sure that we can, you know, hold to our standards and keep producing our carriers here in Michigan. And so we don't want to get to the point where, you know, our only option is to send production overseas. So we want to keep growing, but we want to kind of keep it manageable so that we can continue making them ourselves. Because we do, my sister actually works for me full time, and she and I sew every single carrier.
You sew every single carrier. So
we
this
do,
is
yeah.
truly a family business in the purest sense of the word.
Yeah.
Now, do you sell outside of Michigan?
We do. We sell all over the U.S. We ship directly to consumers in every state, also Canada and internationally. We also have retailers all over the U.S. We have distribution in the U.K. and Japan, and then we also have a couple stores in Singapore and Malaysia.
So this is a seriously global business that you're running right here out of your almost out of your home, right?
Yeah.
How many units do you sell in ballpark in a year?
Around 1,500.
What do you hear from your customers?
Well, that they can go places that you can't take a stroller. for people who have more than one kid, it's super helpful to be able to have your hands free so that you can still interact with your toddler or older child and be close to your baby at the same time.
Andrea Govender and her husband own Action Baby Carriers. Andrea, it was great talking with you. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It has been a pretty busy month in Lansing, with lawmakers introducing bills and resolutions. Detroit Free Press Lansing Bureau reporter Kathy Gray has compiled a list of the bills and resolutions introduced so far in March. Kathy, what's the latest tally?
Well, in March so far, there was 113 bills introduced, and if history repeats itself, about 40 of those will actually become law. And, you know, there's some pretty controversial bills that have been introduced, some pretty mundane ones, too.
Well, let's start with the House, and what can you tell us about House Bill 4279, the Life Begins at Conception Bill?
That is an anti-abortion bill. It basically affords all the rights that are given to human beings, to fetuses, at the moment of conception. And so this could work to ban virtually all abortions. It could also work to criminalize abortions. And several states have tried to pass these types of bills, and they've usually been shot down in the federal court system.
Yeah, because abortion being legal in the United States, and you wonder how does this bill from Representative Cindy Gamrot, how would that ever trump federal statutes?
Right. And, you know, if it did come up for a hearing, if it did make its way through the legislature, I have to think that Governor Snyder could veto something like that. He has vetoed other abortion legislation in his first term, and it would certainly be challenged by abortion rights supporters.
And also from Representative Gamrot is House Bill 4309, which sounds like it's kind of along the same line.
Yes, and this bill would allow medical personnel and hospitals to refuse service that they find objectionable based on religious objections. And this is a bill that also got introduced in the Senate last year and made its way out of committee but never got taken up in the full Senate. So I don't know. I mean, this legislature is a bit more conservative than the last one, so it could come up, and I think it will certainly get a hearing in the House. And, you know, that's a very controversial bill, too. Certain facilities can already refuse to provide birth control services, things like that, some of the religious hospitals. But this could make this reach even further.
So it could broaden that.
Yes, absolutely.
Now, a lot of drivers in Michigan are wishing that instead of dumping the road funding question right into the laps of voters the way the lame duck legislature did, that they would come up with a plan and affect it. But here we have three representatives Gamrot again, and also Todd Corser and Gary Glenn, resurrecting parts of a plan for road funding that didn't make it through the legislature last year.
Right. It would redirect a sales tax that is now charged on gasoline, which now goes to schools and local governments and things like that. It would redirect that money towards roads. The problem with that is then you've got to try to fill the gap that schools and local governments are going to experience if that money isn't available for them. And this is the plan that Speaker Bolger introduced last year. Parts of it passed the House, and they didn't pass the Senate, went for a more aggressive plan that raised more money for roads, and that didn't get through either. So, you know, this is the plan B if the road funding plan doesn't pass in the statewide ballot proposal on May 5th. Whether or not it will get through is a totally different question.
Mm. Now, there was, I noticed in the list that you had in Sunday's Free Press of these bills and resolution, one that, that kind of jumped out at me. It's not the most earth-shaking issue, but I think I've heard a lot of people saying it. Why don't we get rid of daylight savings times? What purpose does it make? And I guess Representative Jeff Irwin of Ann Arbor wonders the same thing.
That's right. That's right. Well, the University of Michigan came out with a study that said that the day that we go back onto Eastern Standard Time is one of the most disruptive days of the years for people's health and things like that. Whether or not you believe that, that's a different story. A couple of states have gone back and done away with daylight savings time. I think Alaska is considering it also. You know, this one I don't quite get, but there are some people who just don't like it. So,
well, it is annoying running around the house deciding whether or not you've changed all your clocks. And can we find out a little more? Apparently, Representative Irwin is also planning to introduce legalizing marijuana in Michigan.
He is planning on introducing that. Plus, there's a couple of ballot proposal groups out there that are looking to perhaps put it on the 2016 ballot. And I think a ballot proposal is probably more likely than the legislature coming up to legalize marijuana.
And Kathy, now over to the Senate. What are some of the more significant measures that you see?
One interesting one is that it would require all the statewide elected officials to file financial disclosure forms. And it would be for candidates, too, not just the people who get elected. And so we'll get to learn more about our candidates for office that way. I don't expect that one to pass. There's another one that would change the way electoral votes are distributed, and it wouldn't be a winner-take-all system, which we have right now. It would be a proportional system that if the first place person got 56% of the vote, he'd get 56% of the electoral college votes, and the second place winner would get the rest. There's several different plans for that, and that's always been kind of controversial. Another one would add water containers to the state's bottle deposit law. And this gets introduced every legislative session, and it hasn't really gone anywhere, but it's certainly one that everybody likes to look at.
Well, there's a big, big, long list, lots more bills that you can check out with Kathleen Gray's story in the Sunday Free Press. Just go to freep.com and it'll be there. And you're going to be kind of doing a regular weekly roundup of the most interesting bills. So we'll have to keep on this with you. It's an interesting way to kind of see what conversations at least are getting started, whether these will ever see the light in day in terms of actually becoming laws.
Right. And, you know, I've gotten some pretty good response of this from people who want to see what's being proposed in Lansing before all of a sudden there's the final vote for it. And this way they can talk to their legislators and tell them how they feel about some of these bills.
Kathy Gray, Detroit Free Press, Lansing Bureau. Always great talking with you. Thank you, Kathy.
Thanks, Cindy.
Now that spring's in the air, many around the state may be planning a visit to Detroit, whether to watch the Wings, hopefully in the playoffs, catch a Tigers game, tour the DIA, or hit one of the many bars or restaurants growing up around Detroit. As Detroit has emerged from the largest municipal bankruptcy in U.S. history, there's been a pretty strong narrative of a new Detroit attracting energetic entrepreneurs and business owners. And that includes a growing bar and restaurant district along Michigan Avenue in Corktown, just west of downtown. But that new image of Detroit got somewhat smudged a few weeks ago when on a single weekend, seven vehicles were reportedly stolen in the 3rd District, including Corktown. After the thefts made some waves on social media, Detroit Police Chief James Craig promised action. P.J. Ryder is a Corktown business owner. He owns and operates P.J.'s Lager House on Michigan Avenue. Good to have you with us, P.J.
Thank you very much.
Tell us a little about P.J.'s Lager House. What kind of place is it and how long have you been open?
The building itself has been there 100 years. This is the 100-year anniversary of the opening of that building. We've owned it since October of 2007. It has, over the course of time, been a place for Irish Catholic, Democratic politics, Teamster politics, all kinds of different things. And in the last 20 years, it's been more known as a music bar, and that's what we concentrate on. And I think we have as good a food as anybody you're going to find any place, personally. We do gumbo and jambalaya. We do a whole lot of different vegetarian dishes and things like that. In a nutshell, restaurant, bar, and rock and roll music.
And PJ, so there you were. You've been in Corktown since before this recent burst of the new restaurants and bars, the Motor City Wine, St. Cece's, and those. And here we have this spate of stolen cars that we're hearing about where customers come to Corktown to have dinner, they walk out, and no car. Has that happened at your place?
I can't say there's never been a car stolen from my place, but first of all, one thing to understand is we don't own any of the parking lots around us. I don't own any of that. I own my building and the land my building's on, and that's it. But I do have lots next door at the Brooklyn Local 1266, which is a diner, and next door at the Detroit Institute of Bagels, which opened up recently. And I pay someone to be there pretty much every day from 5 o'clock till 2 in the morning. And he sits out in that car and flashes light. And in all honesty, we haven't had too much problem at all ever since I went with that. All the individual positions at my bar, I pay the guy that sits out in the parking lot more money than anybody else just to have him there every single night.
Can you give us a ballpark idea of what you spend for security, PJ?
I spend about $30,000 a year.
That's a lot of money.
It's a lot of money. It's the difference between making money and losing money last year. The accountant says we lost $10,000 and we spent $30,000 on security. So, but years ago, Phil Cooley, who owns Slows, told me, he says, that's one of the things about cost of doing business in Detroit. If you're successful, you have to provide security because there's a lot of knuckleheads out there and there's only so much you can do to stop them. You know, that's why for me, it's become absolutely essential for me to have someone out there every night because I just can't let things happen to my customers' cars, whether in my lot or somebody else's lot.
Maybe car thefts are going up as more establishments are bringing in more customers who, you know, frankly, have nice cars.
Well, parking in Corktown is going to become a problem. It's becoming a problem as we speak, just because of the new businesses and the new activity and lack of long-term planning as far as parking or Michigan Avenue or anything like that. Now, one of the things that we've instituted to try to start to direct some of that energy and where it goes is about 2 years ago, Ron Cooley and myself and Dave and Dennis from Ottava Villa and Mercury Burger Bar got together and said, we need a business association. So we've been in existence about 2 years, have around 100 members right now, and we're beginning to try to put a little direction on where things are going. Like, for example, we have the new Tiger Stadium development that's going to come in. And again, that's going to create a situation where you're going to have kids playing baseball and their parents and friends and family all coming down to see them, and they're all going to need someplace to park. As far as the car thieves thing, Detroit Police, about a year and a half ago now, instituted a regular daytime patrol of Corktown, and the officers that are involved are very much involved in trying to figure out who's doing what, when, and unfortunately, there was a van stolen from the back of Detroit Institute of Bagels from one of my tenants who lives upstairs from the bar. It was found about 2 weeks later with four guys in it with multiple guns in it. They got arrested. They got tied to 14 different crimes. And according to the local police officer, told me the other day, two of them were released the other day without any charges whatsoever.
That must make you just feel so frustrated.
Well, because the very next weekend was the weekend that you're talking about. They were released on a Wednesday. The next weekend, all those things happened in Corktown. It's kind of frustrating, yeah, because we don't know if it was them or not, but yeah. It sure seems like too much, because since they were arrested about a month and a half ago, we have not had any incidents whatsoever. So I often think it's a very small group of people, but they're very professional. I mean, years ago, before I installed cameras, before I installed lights, I used to think they were, you know, druggies or somebody breaking a car just to steal something. No, these are professionals. They show up, they circle the block, they scope out certain cars and things like that. So I encourage people to park in the lots. If there's a charging lot, like I know over at Slows, they have a lot behind the Mercury Burger Bar that charges to be in it. And sometimes you're, oh, I don't want to pay for parking. Well, sometimes you're better off paying for parking. Otherwise, I advise people to park, you know, fairly near someone with a flashing light on their car so that you have someone there. Because quite frankly, most of these thieves are not interested in staying around someplace where they might be seen. That's why it happens at night. It very rarely, if ever, happens during the day because it's the cover of night that they can get away from. There's also a long-term plan that could make a huge difference if MDOT decided to do something with Michigan Avenue to make it less of a freeway. It's 9 lanes wide right now. If they narrowed it down to 5 lanes and slowed traffic down to 25 miles an hour, probably have a little less way to escape from the Corktown neighborhood. Because right now, you have access to the lodge, you have access to 75, Michigan Avenue, Rosa Parks. You can get out of the neighborhood fast if you do something. Thieves look for the place where they can get away from easily. Well, Corktown has great access from outside Corktown. It also has great access to get away from the place.
Yeah.
But I think across the board, most Corktown business owners, especially if they do have access or own a lot, are putting security out there almost every single night. They know they can't let something happen to their customers on a regular basis, so they're going to lose their customers. So we're a cold Corktown Association, Business Association, and individual business owners are all quite concerned about this and do put some serious effort into it and some serious cost. I think I was told, I talked to Ron at Slows, and I think he said they spent over $65,000 a year on security over there.
Certainly not unaware. You're trying to protect your customers.
Yeah, we're very aware of it, and we really try hard. I mean, the police officer, Toy, who is our neighborhood police officer, if something happens in the neighborhood, he's coming over to look at my videotape, to look at Metro Tech across the street's videotape, to look at Detroit Institute of Bagels videotape, and actually we are beginning a video network for the whole neighborhood where we would all have access to cameras everywhere at all times. But that's a little beyond our scope right now, but we're working on something like that to try to, you know, get a handle on it, because what happens if I have someone in my lot and Nemos has somebody in their lot, or Tavavia has someone in their lot, but maybe there's nobody at McShane's lot. It'll be McShane's lot that gets hit. So we're kind of getting to the point now where we're trying to have security pretty much throughout any area where people would park.
I got to ask you, PJ. So customer says, I want to come support one of these Corktown establishments. You drive down there, and the parking lot is full. Do you go on the street and hope your car is there, roll the dice when you come out, or do you turn around and go home? Are you afraid of losing potential customers?
Okay, I've parked in Corktown every day for close to 8 years, and not one thing has ever happened to my car. Now, I park night, day. My car doesn't say, this is PJ's car, don't touch it, or anything like that.
Sure.
And I've never had a problem. So what do you do? Very rarely are you ever going to have a problem on Michigan Avenue. But if you park back on Brooklyn, on Cherry Street, behind the Brooklyn Loft, there's nobody back there. And, yes, you are opening yourself up to it. But I suggest to anyone who's coming down here, don't wait 2.5 hours to go eat someplace. You know, if someone walks into someplace and says it's going to be a 2-hour wait, walk to the next restaurant. There's a lot of good restaurants around here, and you can go to different ones without waiting, 2.5 hours to get in. But like I said, I've parked on the street, I've parked on the side streets, I've parked in the lots, and I've never had an incident. But that doesn't mean it can't happen to someone. And the way the thieves work is their boss says, I need such and such tires, and I need such and such airbag, and I need such and such. And they go out and look for that car. And if someone targets your car, as John F. Kennedy says, if they want to kill you, they're going to kill you. And there's nothing to do about it. But car thefts in Detroit are down like 60%. It's still higher than most any other city around, but they're down like 60%. And that makes a huge difference, but it's going to happen. I mean, there are knuckleheads out there. We are a poor city, and there are thieves that make their living doing this. I think that there are part shops in the city that hire people to go out and get stuff for them, and they get it off the street, and they bring it in, and the shop owners buy it. That's after watching the videotape, seeing how people operate, talking to the police, this has got to be... Everybody's got to make the efforts. Like, it's like not only the business owners, the business association, the city of Detroit police, we'll do everything we can. I can suggest to people who are parking on the street, don't leave anything in your car. Don't leave a laptop on there, or a purse, or even a box full of stuff, or even a box empty. I heard one story about someone breaking their car, and they said, why are you breaking into my car? There's an empty box in there. And the guy said, I didn't know it was empty. That's why I broke in their car. So it's an overall problem. I don't think it's primarily focused in Corktown. I think there is stolen cars all over the city every day. But we are doing our best as a business organization and as individual business owners.
PJ Ryder is the owner and the operator of PJ's Lager House, has been open on Michigan Avenue in Corktown since 2007, giving us the view from a member of the Corktown Business Association. PJ Ryder, thank you so much for talking with us on Stateside.
You are very welcome.
Today's Stateside was directed by Allie Billings. Our executive producer is Zoe Clark. Our engineer today was Bob Scon. Contributors are Mercedes Mejia, Mike Blank, Emily Fox, Haley Hirschman, Joe Lindstroth, Annie Norris, Lindsay Scullin, and Katrina Schaefer. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.
Support for the next idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.